I can remember from about 1989, the Stone Roses, but that was from just a week or so ago, and his name is Ian Brown, who's the Stone Roses front man, and that song is called Little Seed, Big Tree. Martin, the whole idea of creating a kind of culture here, I mean, that's, for example, not played on the radio, is it? None of these things that we play in between the first hour and the second hour are being played at all on the radio. Back, if you were to go back to, say, for example, the Vietnam War years, right, 1960s and 70s, there was a tremendous amount of protest music around, protest songs, which were being played all around the world.
Well, I mean, if you remember, at one stage, Radio Caroline existed because the BBC wouldn't play pop music in general. So I don't think we can think back to the era,
maybe an era of freedom of speech.
But
it was because of Radio Caroline. Certainly freedom of culture. And I suppose what I'm trying to do is what they were doing then. And I've had various people say to me that when listening to your show sounds like pirate radio.
Well, there you are. That's, you know, that's
the ultimate compliment.
Yeah, but really. I mean, the fact is that people, because of the technology changes, people can now produce, a pretty listenable product. For a relatively inexpensive amount of money. But, of course, back in those days, Radio Caroline existed, but, of course, they needed a ship, which is quite expensive. It's not just a studio, is it?
I don't think it takes a lot of money to make music, does it, really? I mean, say, for example, I was reading the other day about the band Hawkwind, who were just some record producer, just saw this guy strumming away and playing as a busker, and he was picked up and given a recording contract. Basically, was with got a few more mates together, and off they went. Hawkwind, the band.
Well, I think in the late 70s there were lots of independent labels which grew up and so on. So there was a period when the way the music industry operated was transformed, particularly in this country. But what tends
to
happen?
But where are the impresarios today? There aren't any, are there? That are finding new talent and bringing that talent
on. Well, listen, there's the big entertainment companies are still churning out their product. They're making big money out of it.
I would recommend people have a look at Mark Devlin. He was on our show last week. We only had a fairly short clip from him, but there's a much longer interview there about what's happened to the music industry. Mark was on Galaxy FM here in the 1990s and into the noughties in Bristol on FM, and now he's decided that, well, he's come out with the same sort of stuff that we talk about mind control, conspiracies, financial manipulation of political parties, censorship in the mass media, and he's found himself lost his job. But he's been writing a lot about the music industry. What he's saying effectively, Martin, is that the cultural industries are an enormous target in the battle against humanity by the global elite.
Well, the production of culture has always been a battleground for different ideas. And look at all the people who are making a living by just putting stuff up on TikTok. That wasn't possible in my youth.
People are making a living by putting stuff up on YouTube, but then I got demonetized just after the 2016 Brexit vote, when I had one of my videos called What the BBC Won't Tell You About Brexit went over 1.7 million hits, and I started getting some real revenue, and suddenly YouTube decided, oh no, we're not going to monetize you anymore. So of course, anybody that's actually getting somewhere with this alternative media, but certainly if it's part of the kind of YouTube, Google fraternity, Twitter, Facebook type people, they're demonetized. So any potential income that you've got from that is cut off rather swiftly.
Well, the other thing they're doing as well, of course, is changing the algos so that when you search for something, most people only look at the top three things they find, and you can still be there, but if you're on page two, you've got no chance of anybody finding you. And basically, these are private companies which are embedded with the deep state, and they're under no obligation to give everybody a fair go, any more than the Daily Mail is. And that's free speech. If you, in one sense, well, you can say what you like, but nobody can hear.
Yeah, it's a form of psychological warfare to just cut these things. We were hearing a bit about that from Indonesia, from Andre Vilcek, the things that he discovered there about the 1960s, as you quite rightly said, Martin, coup organised by Henry Kissinger in Indonesia. But let's look at some of the stories this week, Martin. And a lot of it is to do with sanctions, isn't it? US, UK, and France are all putting sanctions on Belarus because apparently they didn't win. Lukashenko did not win the election, and also new sanctions going on to Iran from the United States. Iran is helping Syria rebuild its air defences after months of Israeli attacks, and that, I'm afraid, the US say, right, well, if you're helping the Syrians rebuild their air defences, we're going to sanction you.
Well, they're being sanctioned anyway. You know, it's hard to see what other sanctions the US, because they're withdrawing from the GCPRA, they're now saying that anybody who does deals with the Iranians, they will sanction them. And therefore, various companies have pulled out of Iran, but the Chinese, who are already under US sanctions, said, well, we will take over where those companies, we will support you. So we're shaping, you know, the sanctions are effectively an act of war, and therefore we are basically at war already, and it's going to get worse.
We'll start off though this week. I mean, we'll cover some more of these international stories in a minute, but I think really Andre Vilcek was an incredible guy, wasn't he? I mean, I met him a couple of times, and I just also we used to interview him for this show from time to time, particularly anything to do with Russia and Eastern Europe. He was, like you, Martin, quite an expert on that.
Well, he's Russian, although he was a US citizen. Incidentally, he died. He's 55 years old, and he died in a car in Turkey. And the Turkish authorities, as I understand it, are treating it as potentially suspicious.
He was travelling overnight in his vehicle and arrived at a hotel in Istanbul in the early hours of the morning. His wife was driving the car, and then when she tried to revive him, she found he died in the back of the car.
Yeah, well, I mean, people die all the time, but as I understand it, the Turks are not necessarily happy that there's no foul play.
So some suggestions he may have been poisoned. Why would anybody want to be rid of journalists like Andre?
Well, I mean, he basically was an enemy of what people call the New World Order. He was against the US imperialist power. He was pretty left-wing in most of his views and attitudes. And, you know, as you know, he wrote books, he made films, he wrote poetry, he was quite prominent. And, that's those kind of people make enemies, don't they?
I think it was Exposing the Lies of the Empire was one of his big, thick books. But, I mean, he was a real campaigner against the, I suppose, Israeli, US, British world order, and NATO particularly.
Well, that's right. Therefore, you know, obviously, when he dies that young, in suspicious circumstances, it raises questions, doesn't it?
He worked in Chile as well. He lived for a while in Chile, and he was one of the people who was involved after Pinochet was removed in helping to denazify the country. Now, I think some people would be surprised to hear that there were real live former Nazis living quite happily in Chile.
Well, as you know, Tony, they were actually embedded in most of the right-wing dictatorships across Latin America, including Martin Bormann, because of your excellent research. People who listen to the show will be well aware of that.
If you could just explain a bit about Andre's, what have you come across that he's, Exposing the Lies of the Empire is one of his greatest books. I mean, probably, I've never read it from cover to cover, but it's a great reference book for all sorts of, in a way, he was doing what we do every week, which is to point out anomalies and lies and conspiracies that are real, not the bogus ones. Because actually, the extension of an empire, particularly at the moment, what we're seeing is the Israeli and the US empire being extended, depends on lies, doesn't it?
Well, of course it does, and the truth always is then regarded as a threat. I didn't agree. What I used to find with about some of his stuff is it's It's a bit long-winded, to be honest. That's what I'd say about it. I often started reading his stuff and think, I've had enough of this, and flicked onto something else, because he was making lots of good points, but there's a great deal of kind of cultural baggage associated with the sharp political points. But nevertheless, he's clearly on the side of the Angels, and it's a shame that he's gone.
One of his major targets was the Israelis and the US and the Brits. But he also went all the way around the world in many places doing films about small countries. Like, I mean, I know Indonesia is not a small country, but what he would do is places where the Western media was neglecting to go and to look at, he would then go in there and do that job.
I mainly come across his stuff on the internet. And he's a pretty mordant critic of Western imperialism, which of course is a real thing. It's not something people make up. Somebody ought to tell Keir Starmer.
Okay, what we're going to do is we're going to hear from Andre talking about Indonesia and the dumbing down of Indonesia after the coup first, and then we'll hear about his analysis from last week, just literally from last week, about Belarus.
When I was filming for Venezuelan Telesur, a documentary film about Surabaya, I was inside of the hall with thousands of people where the preacher was jumping around and yelling, God loves the rich and that's why they are rich. God hates the poor and that's why they are poor. Right? And then you have all sorts of...
That's almost humorous.
It is, but it is... They really believe in this. It has nothing to do with, liberation theology, whatever. It's all extreme forms of the religion. So logically, in prosperity gospel, you go to the churches in Indonesia and you look at some of the services that are in English. They are performed by Australian and North American clearly apparatchiks. You know, I mean, these are people who are therefore indoctrination purposes. These are not just some kind of benign religious leaders. These are tough propaganda gurus, and they of course are following from the local priests. There is humongous corruption problem in the churches, in the mosques, and the West is supporting exactly these sorts of groups and these sorts of sects that are controlling the country. But Kevin, I would like to come back once again to the basic point of this discussion about Indonesia, about 65. One thing that the West doesn't know, and it was kept away from them, is that 1965 and what followed was one enormous experiment on human beings. It was something that was later used in many different countries, but actually you had a slaughter, you had a genocide, you had a Holocaust, in which 40% of teachers of Java were killed. The military was actually coming to classes to teach for some period of time. You had the greatest writers, like Pramudia Anantatur, who was imprisoned. His books were burned, and he was imprisoned for more than 10 years in a Buru concentration camp. He had entire film studios closed down. He had great theater forms of Indonesia totally destroyed. Everything thinking was marginalized. So it was not only Chinese language. It was generally everything. It was attempt to de-intellectualize the entire nation. So as I mentioned in my report about Indonesia, you have a country with 300 million inhabitants, because they lie, you know, they tell you that it has 245 million, but I worked with several UN statisticians and they say they lie even about the number of people. So you have a number, or you have a nation with 300 plus million people without one, you know, recognizable scientist, without one great thinker, without any person that you could quote or you could consider an enlightened personality, the country which translates just the dozens of decent books a year, and the translations are of the horrific quality. You know, it's all based. It was a fed, force fed by Hollywood films, by the lowest grade of pop music. You know, languages, entire languages like Chinese language, like Russian language, were either banned or they were totally marginalized. So they achieved something impossible. They achieved from one of the most they converted one of the most progressive nations on earth to one of the absolutely, you know, least intellectual place. You can talk to Indonesians about anything, you know, from connected to politics, to imperialism, to capitalism. They will not know what you are talking about. The other day I was talking about bombing of Laos during the U.S. Secret War. It's the same ASEAN, the same group of nations. You know, nobody knows about this. They don't know their own history.
Well, that's rather worrying, isn't it? History being controlled. But he Andre there talks, Martin, about this 1965 coup being an experiment on human beings. He was saying effectively, I mean, the slaughter of 40% of the teachers being killed, their jobs being replaced by the military, writers killed, film studios killed, theatres destroyed. This is a kind of cultural war going on.
Yeah, it was one of the biggest crimes of Western imperialism. The Sukarno regime, which was allied with the PKI, the Communist Party of Indonesia, the army got unhappy with that, and they were put up to it by the Americans with British support, of course, as usual, and they carried out a coup, supposedly because of an attempted coup by the PKI, although it's very, very murky what happened there. And then they killed the whole of the PKI's political base, which was up to 1 million people, and they killed them all in most horrible circumstances. And that's capitalist imperialism for you.
But it, I mean, what I find so horrifying about this is him talking about it as an experiment. So the idea is we're going to see how we get on with this, and then maybe we can use this tactic elsewhere. And this is who is he talking about?
Well, one of the things that happened.
I mean, we know Kissinger was involved.
Yeah, well, one of the things that happened in Chile, for example, before the coup in 1973, the right wing used to spray up on the walls, "Indonesia is coming." So that's what it was about. Yeah, it was a model for military coups all over the world against progressive governments. And, of course, it was a particularly brutal process. They killed a lot of people.
Obviously, it wasn't just against the government. It was against the entire nation. Basically, a massive dumbing-down operation to see if they could make people as uneducated and stupid as possible.
Well, it's the people they killed weren't being dumbed down. They were being killed. But then, of course, if you're going to carry on being in power, and Suharto, who took over, was in power for many, many years afterwards as a dictator, eventually overthrown after the 1998 economic crisis in Southeast Asia. But, of course, by that stage, you basically set the country on a capitalist development path, which is no use whatever to more than half the population. What might have happened is a democratic communist party could have come to power with Sukarno as a balancing force, and they could have actually transformed the country and been a positive impact around the world instead of the negative example which they subsequently...
I mean,
and of course, they then invaded East Timor in 1972 and put them under the cosh with the full support of the Australians and the British, etc. And of course, most people in Britain, if you ask somebody in Britain, do you know about the mass murder in Indonesia, they'll go, what? They wouldn't have heard of it. They'll have heard of the communists killing loads of people in China, but they won't have heard about
it. But the interesting thing, point Andre's making there, is that people, even in their own country, don't know their own history.
Well, that's, you know, most dictatorships want that to be the case, don't they? They want those who control the past control the present, and those who control the present control the future. So in actual fact, history is very important in any setup, because people are either aware of it or unaware of it, and that means that they can control current events. And, you know, that's why it's important to keep going back. Who cares about what happened in 1965 in Indonesia? Well, it's just that the Western claim to be in favour of freedom and democracy is completely undermined by the massacre that was carried out. And it was pretty brutal stuff. I mean, I don't know if people have ever seen the film The Year of Living Dangerously, which is about that period. And it's a kind of, you know, it's basically a romantic Hollywood film. There's a love story at the heart of it. But at the end of it, you know, you get the idea, you realise that this is actually, far more people were killed in the Indonesian coup, for example, than were killed in Chile. or in Argentina. Argentina was brutal. They killed tens of thousands. But in Indonesia, they killed millions. Millions of people were dead within weeks of the coup.
So what do you think Andre's legacy is going to be then? I mean, he was kind of squeezed out of much of the media in the West, but he did manage to be a regular filmmaker for example, Telesur in Venezuela.
Well, I think the fact that he's made all of these films and books, they will stand the test of time. And, you know, in the past, of course, if somebody made a film, unless it was shown in some radical cinema down the road from you, you were never going to get to see it. But, of course, you know, he's died now. I encourage people to go to the internet, find his oeuvre, and watch some of his films. Why not?
There's not many people like him around, though.
Well, there aren't, no. There's Stephen Cohen has died in the United States. He was a very, very good analyst of Russia. And, you know, he's basically been shut. He remained in academia because they couldn't get rid of him because he was a professor. But they ignored him for years and years and years. And he's, you know, basically telling them common sense things about Russia. But he died of natural causes. He was quite old. He's in his 80s. Vilcek was only 55. So there's a definite suspicion involved. You know, people do die at 55, but somebody like, and as I say, the Turkish authorities are not necessarily presuming that there's no foul play.
Well, let's have a listen now to one of his final broadcasts. This is on Iran's press TV in English language when he was talking to Vladimir Goldstein.
From Belgrade a few days ago. Now, you have to understand about the government and the system in Belarus. There is no crisis, there is no big tragedy, there is basically a very balanced, socially balanced system. The industry is working, the medical is working, education facilities are working, and so is public transportation. So a group of people who is basically bored and whom Lukashenko is calling bourgeois, or young bourgeois, new bourgeois class, got bored. And they got also subsidized financially from the West, and they are doing precisely what the young kids in Hong Kong have been doing since last year. So there is nothing new. It is a coup, again, attempt by the West. It is very dangerous for Russia. And anyone who followed the situation, political, economical, and social situation in the neighboring Ukraine, would understand what is in store for Belarus if they are going to follow this concept, which is pushed down their throat from the West.
So that's Andrei Vilcek there, Martin, giving a bit of analysis last week about what's been going on over in Belarus, and he was speaking from Istanbul on Press TV.
Yeah, well, I mean, the analysis is pretty good. I was speaking exactly about this topic on RT yesterday. The main problem...
Look, what about what he just said about Hong Kong? He's talking about this as a kind of Ukraine-Hong Kong-style coup attempt. That's what he's saying.
It is. It is. I mean, Canvas, which was set up from Otpor in Serbia... it's basically the CIA MI6 1968 squad, and they basically got plenty of money to spend, and they go around the world encouraging relatively privileged young people to rebel against governments that the West doesn't like, and you know, they then use that as a leverage to try and get the governments out. It's usually not just that as well, they're doing other things at the same time. Lukashenko has been in power since for the last 26 years. He's won 5 elections. This is the 6th election, which he claims that he has won. Now, of course, in the West, you get this idea that if somebody's been in power that long, it should be time for them to go. We all know that democracy, you have to have 2 parties, a left-wing party and a right-wing party, and they're supposed to, take it in turns to run the system, and that's democracy. In other parts of the world, it doesn't run like that. Lukashenko came to power in the early 90s. He used to be a collective farm manager, so he's like a middle manager. And what he did is he said to the people of Belarus, there's only 10 million people there, it's quite a small country, it's not small in size, but it's small in population. And he said, well, we're not going to change anything, we're just going to carry on as we were before. We're not going to get rid of the collective farm, so I'm a collective farm boss, so we're not going to do that. We're going to carry on having state-run enterprises, so that all the major big factories and enterprises in Belarus are still owned by the Belarusian government.
How independent is he really of Putin, though?
Well, he's not that independent, because ultimately he's been able to pursue a welfare state, if you like, inside Belarus, because because for political reasons the Russians have carried on selling him gas and energy at less than world market prices. And of course that's a trade-off that the Russians are willing to make, because they, you know, basically Belarus for them is a buffer state between them and the West. And of course, all the Western analysis of this has presumed that he must have lost the election. And of course, in actual fact, it's more than likely that he won the election. He's won the last five. Why is he going to lose this one? And the answer is he's not. There's lots of younger people who've only just, you know, basically, if you're under the age of 26, you've lived under Lukashenko's rule all your life. And that probably runs into the 30s. You know, people in their mid-30s have never known anybody else running the country. And they get frustrated. You know, they want to have a Western-style setup where they can set up their internet startups and make loads of money. But, of course, the actual people who vote him in are the people who work in the collective farms and the state enterprises who don't want that at all.
The connection with here, I suppose, is that we were talking about a couple of weeks ago about RAF Fairford and these B-52s flying over there, Martin. These are big American aircraft taking off from Fairford, heading over to Ukraine and Belarus, and then flying along along the Russian border, right on the, literally, you know, the bit of airspace a few inches away from Russia. Now, this does seem to be an excuse for the Americans to come and flex their muscles when things like this happen, but of course they're also spending money on the ground, surely. NGOs in Belarus.
That's right. A lot of the people in the opposition are being paid to do the sort of thing we're doing for nothing. Yeah. They have, like, just Joshua Wong in Hong Kong. And of course, one of the main things that most people who are protesting do not realize is that in the Maidan Square in 2014 in Ukraine, there was a big protest, you know, in the Maidan Square. The Berkut riot police were trying to police it. And then people infiltrated themselves into high buildings nearby and killed over 80 people.
The big hotel, Ukraine,
right.
Wasn't it?
Yes, that's right, and the opera. And they were professional snipers, and they killed over 80 protesters and several police officers. And on the back of that, the government fell, even though they'd done a deal with the opposition about an early election, and Yanukovych had to flee back to Russia. There's been a court case in Kiev where the Berkut riot police have been completely vindicated. They did not shoot the demonstrators. And it was proved in the court because there was a video link to Georgia by two of the actual snipers. And they said all of the snipers were brought in by NATO from Georgia, and they killed both the pro-EU
demonstrators. So this was basically a NATO-EU-US court coup.
Yeah, but it's a false flag.
Let's just move on to talk about, Martin, talk about Alexei Navalny, because this week he's been discharged from hospital, another one who has managed to survive this deadly nerve agent Novichok.
Yes, which was designed to kill whole battalions of troops, but apparently it's been used twice and failed both times. Extraordinary, eh?
Incredible, isn't it, since it's such an incredible nerve agent. But the BBC talk about the background. They say Navalny's supporters initially believed his tea was spiked at Tomsk Airport in Siberia before he caught a flight to Moscow. However, they later said that traces of the nerve agent were found on a water bottle in the hotel room where he'd been staying.
Yeah, so what the story keeps changing, as these things do. His entourage went back to the hotel where he'd stayed, and nobody had tidied up, and the water bottle that he'd used was lying there. So they took it away, and then they gave it to a military laboratory inside Germany. And then the military laboratory in Germany found Novichok on the bottle, but they'd carried it all the way there on an aeroplane covered in Novichok. None of them got ill. And then they gave it to the military in Germany, and wow, they found Novichok on the bottle. Can you believe that?
In an Instagram post on Tuesday, Mr. Navalny rubbished suggestions, supposedly from President Putin, that he had poisoned himself.
he's probably, if he may well have been poisoned. Don't forget he's diabetic as well. So this may be just diabetes. But if he's been poisoned, he's been poisoned by something which doesn't kill him so that we can create this
Well, yeah, there is a bit of evidence for this, though, because the French newspaper Le Monde reported in a telephone call from President Emmanuel Macron on the 14th of September, Vladimir Putin spoke with contempt about Alexei Navalny, considering him a simple internet troublemaker who had simulated diseases in the past. Putin has outsmarted me, Mr. Navalny wrote on Instagram, mocking the Russian president. He's nobody's fool as a result. I, like a fool, spent 18 days in a coma but failed to achieve what I wanted. The provocation has failed.
Well, I mean, that's just an exchange of words, isn't it? I mean, underlying all of this is that Navalny could have been poisoned. I think the Skripals were probably poisoned with something like fentanyl. And don't forget that the doctor in the hospital said, we've not treated anybody for nerve agents in this hospital, in the Times, the following day. But, of course, it all just disappears into the memory hole. It just doesn't pass the smell test, does it?
It doesn't.
It's absurd.
Look, just for a moment, just back to the B-52s, because you pointed out to me, Martin, over the border between Ukraine and Russia, that the Russian planes tried a rather smart manoeuvre on those B-52s, didn't they? They didn't just hang around. They rather showed that they were better flyers. Obviously, these little, I think they are Tupolev fighters or something, are rather better at flying than the old B-52s, aren't they?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's hardly been reported in the West, but what they've been doing is flying nuclear-armed B-52s along the Russian border, from the north to the south, and then round the Crimea.
So I noticed.
So the Russians are basically looking at these B-52s that at any moment could fire a missile, a nuclear-tipped missile, into Russia. And that is, can you imagine if the Russians were flying round
fair,
and round Britain
the Americans
with
refused,
nuclear-armed
the
bombs?
The Americans refuse to say whether there are nuclear weapons on there or not.
Well, the Russians have already said any missile that comes in our direction, we have to presume that it's nuclear. And therefore, we're going to full DEFCON 3 straight off. Because that's the only way to deal with that. And of course, what it means is, at some point, one of these planes will be shot down, and then the Americans will turn around to everybody, they've shot our plane down. Yes, so that's because you're flying them, literally, you know, meters away from the Russian border, all the way along the Russian border. Now, that is just that's what the Irish call coat trailing. Yeah? It's what they used to do at the county fairs. People would trail their coat on the ground, and people would stand on the coat to start a fight.
So the Russian Su-27 fighter, this is really at the end of last month, not this week or last week. I was quite amazed to watch the footage, and I put it up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, of the Su-27 hanging behind the B-52. Then what it does is it comes up quite close to it, and then it does a rolling turn right in front of the B-52, which creates a lot of turbulence and eddies, and you can see the guys who are filming in the cabin, the cockpit of the B-52. The whole plane is going up and down. It's wobbling because of the manoeuvre that the Russian fighter has done.
Yeah, I'd be interested to know where they actually carried that manoeuvre. I mean, in actual fact, there are basically interceptions like that going on weekly, several a week.
But the Russians are not taking it lying down.
No,
they're
no,
saying,
Shoigu, the defence minister, has said, if you come 1 inch into Russian territory, we're going to shoot you down.
Yeah, so this is the Su-27 fighter. So this is sort of thing is going on quite a bit. But what bothers me more than anything else is this. We've got these are all based in Fairford, just up the road from here, these B-52s.
Well, everything's connected to everything else. What's very important about this is, as I understand it, they've been flying along the official border between Ukraine and Russia. So in other words, they're overflying the Donbass and Luhansk republics. And of course, they have got no air defence.
I actually admire these Russian pilots. That what they're saying is, look, just don't mess us around. The Pentagon has said the repeated manoeuvres caused turbulence for the B-52, making it difficult for the pilot to maintain control of the aircraft.
Well,
I don't want to. The losing control of a B-52 could be quite nasty.
Well, indeed, it's basically brinkmanship, and it ought to be made news in the West that we're doing this. And of course, what the Russians could do is do similar things in the North Sea. And at that point, people will be saying, what are they doing? But of course, they're not doing that because it's provocative, and they're not acting provocatively, unlike the Western imperialists.
Talking about air power, US spy plane disguised itself while flying over the Yellow Sea. China said the US disguised its spy planes as civilian aircraft 100 times. According to a Beijing think tank that monitors flights in the region, US Air Force plane is disguising itself as a Philippines aircraft while flying over the Yellow Sea. The South China Sea Strategic Situation Probing Initiative observed the flight. Another flight monitoring agency, Aircraft Spots, made a similar observation, noticed the plane used a different hex code when it was over the Yellow Sea between China's coast and the Korean Peninsula. These are international numbers used to identify aircraft. It said the US Air Force plane used a hex code assigned to a Philippine aircraft while over the South China Sea, switched back to its original when the mission was over. So the Americans are using electronic trickery to pretend that they are Philippines aircraft when actually they're US military aircraft.
Yeah, well, what that leads to is a situation where some civilian aircraft may be shot down by accident. This is the sort of thing that's going on all the time. And just by accident, we could end up with a major international incident which will lead immediately to potential nuclear war. People ought to be paying a lot more attention to this than they are.
Meanwhile, looking at the Steele dossier, do you want to just remind us what that was, Martin?
Well, it was basically a sort of private sector cobbled together thing about how Trump was unfit to be president because the Russians had compromat on him, and it looks like the source for a lot of the gossip.
So we're saying Russian could blackmail Trump.
Yeah, so a lot of the gossip. It was Christopher Steele who put the dossier together, who's ex-MI6. And Pablo Miller, who was also ex-MI6, who is, I think he's still in MI6, who was Skripal's handler. And Skripal was the source of lots of the gossip, including the very believable story that Trump paid for Russian prostitutes to piss on the bed that Obama had slept in. And of course, it was all exposed. You see, this is the Steele dossier and the so-called Russiagate affair are at the root of what happened in Salisbury, which has got nothing to do with the Russians at all. It's basically internal battles within the US and British security services.
So anyway, The Hill, which is a political paper in the US, is saying the Steele dossier source was a subject of an FBI counterintelligence probe this week. So a subsource used to compile the so-called Steele dossier, a controversial opposition research document against the candidate Donald Trump, was previously the subject of an FBI counterintelligence investigation, the Attorney General William Barr said in a letter released this week. Yesterday, in fact, the details previously redacted from a footnote in Justice Department Inspector Michael Horowitz's 2019 report on four Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act FISA court warrant applications. But US Attorney John Durham, tapped by Barr to review the origins of the FBI Russia probe, signed off on Barr releasing the detail to Senate Judiciary Committee Lindsey Graham, who's doing his own investigation into the FBI's probe into Russia's 2016 election meddling. So the declassified footnote states the primary subsource was the subject of an FBI counterintelligence investigation from 2009 to 2011 that attested that her documented contacts with suspected Russian counterintelligence officers. So anyway, the person's being investigated for actually exactly what the dossier is saying, which is for being involved with the Russians.
Well, both sides in the ridiculous debate about this in the US are accusing the other side of being in the pocket of the Russians. And of course, the Russians basically have nothing to do with it. This is an internal struggle between different factions within the Western security services. The Russians basically are just being used as a weapon.
And what we're hearing here, of course, is a lot of stuff to do with disclosure. So this should have been disclosed early on. We're only ever getting half the truth with stories like this, aren't we?
Well, that's right, and who can follow all the tedious detail of it all? The fundamental thing, of course, is that the Democratic National Committee was rigging the primaries against Bernie Sanders in the run-up to the 2016 election, and somebody, probably Seth Rich, who was actually the head of the IT for the DNC, gave all the details on a memory stick to Craig Murray, the former British ambassador to Uzbekistan in Washington, and then WikiLeaks published it. And of course, immediately the Democrats started screaming that the Russians had hacked their emails. Now, in actual fact, nobody had hacked their emails. William Binney, who used to head up the NSA, said nobody hacked this. This came off clearly because of the electronic signal of it. This is somebody who's taken it away in a memory stick. And, of course, Seth Rich was then murdered in a so-called robbery where they didn't take either his credit card or his wallet. And that looks as if he was basically done in, because he was the one who'd passed the material to WikiLeaks. And what that material shows is that US elections are rigged. Now, even if the Russians had hacked that out and told everybody, they'd be doing us all a favour. But in actual fact, there were nothing to do with it. Basically, US elections are rigged. Can you hear that out there in radio land? They're rigged.
The US has cut, says the Middle East Eye this week, $20 million in funding for a group which is helping pro-democracy efforts in Iran. Well, that's an interesting one, isn't it? Because they've got a democracy in Iran. They don't have it in many other countries. Maybe they should be spending this money in places like the UAE or Saudi Arabia, Martin. The Open Technology Fund supports activists operating in Iran, Belarus and Hong Kong, helping them bypass internet censorship and state surveillance. So the Trump administration has blocked a $20 million grant for a pro-democracy organization operating in Iran, Belarus and Hong Kong.
Well, I'd be interested to know why they've blocked that particular expenditure, because basically taxpayers' money, including British taxpayers' money, spent on things like the Integrity Initiative and the Institute for Statecraft, are basically involved in manipulating elections and political situations all over the world at our expense. And therefore, you know, they then, one of the things they were caught out doing, of course, was spreading tweets attacking Jeremy Corbyn.
You want to know why? The article says that PAC has declined to comment, but his office suggested the funding freeze, as well as other changes, was implemented over security concerns such as OTF staff. This is the organisation concerned, using Zoom and being careless with computer drives. So obviously they're saying that you shouldn't be using Zoom because this is easy to put under surveillance.
But Zoom, as we all know, is a plot like TikTok by the Chinese Communist Party to spy on everybody. So that's possibly what that's about. Well, of course, it is Donald Trump who said that the buildings were bombed on 9/11, and it's Donald Trump who assassinated Soleimani, nearly starting World War III in January last year. I wouldn't vote for him. I wouldn't really want to vote for Biden either, but it's Hobson's choice, isn't it?
Also in a Middle East Monitor, MPs this week are urging the UK to recognise Palestine and boycott settlement products. Speaking during a House of Commons debate on settlements and annexation, UK members of Parliament called on the government to immediately recognise the state of Palestine. So that's another call for that happening here in the UK, Martin.
Yeah, but it won't get passed because the Tory majority, which are all pro-Israeli, will basically ensure that nothing happens.
Minister of State for the Middle East and North Africa, James Cleverly, said in Parliament yesterday, "We desire a stable, secure and peaceful two-state solution, a thriving Israel next door to a thriving Palestine based on the 1967 borders with agreed land swaps, Jerusalem as a shared capital of both states with fair, agreed and realistic settlements." But we're a long way from that, aren't we?
We certainly are.
Is he living in cloud cuckoo land, James?
No, what he's
not
doing,
very clever, is
no,
it?
No, what he's doing is they're pretending that they're trying to be even-handed when we all know that they're not. And, of course, the Palestinians are being sold out now by the unelected governments of UAE and Bahrain. And, of course, back in the day when we were having the Arab Spring, we were encouraging people to rise up and start fighting against Gaddafi and Assad. Get your guns out. And, of course, if they did that in Bahrain, obviously they're not going to do that, but they might. Obviously, in Yemen, British military personnel are directly involved in the biggest humanitarian crisis on the planet by helping the Saudi pilots are still training in this country. And then they go straight back to Saudi to bomb children.
In the US, Mint Press News are the reporting Kushner-linked firm and gig economy set to reap huge profits as mass evictions begin. So we were talking about this in the first hour here domestically, Martin, but it's happening in the US too. With threats of homelessness and bankruptcy in the air as eviction moratoriums subside, renters and small landlords are getting pinched by predatory tech capitalism in the gig economy. It's the real estate market. So what's happened is we've got these massive companies, Kushner linked. Jared Kushner, of course, is very well placed in the White House, pro-Israel lobby chap. And he's looking to actually make a lot of money out of these. Basically, what they do is these vulture capitalists sit and wait for things called distressed assets. So, in other words, where there is an asset that you are having to evict someone because they can't pay the rent, Kushner will come along and say, oh, I'll buy it for a song.
That's right. It's all there in Naomi Klein's book, Disaster Capitalism, and Jared Kushner is a classic disaster capitalist, like Peter Singer, if people have come across him. There's plenty of them. Christian Oddie in this country is shorting the pound, even though he's 100% Brexiteer, because that's the way to make money, isn't it?
So let's also have a look at another, I think, big story this week, which is the UN. We got some speeches now from some of the, or clips from them, from some of the world leaders. I've seen very little coverage of this, Martin. Again, I suppose, because it's maybe because it's on Zoom. Tensions between the US and China, though, came to the fore at the annual UN General Assembly. They say in New York, but it's not really in New York, it's virtual, with US President Donald Trump blaming China for the spread of coronavirus. He called for China to be held accountable, as he put it, for the pandemic. Chinese President Xi Jinping said his country had no intention to enter a Cold War with any country. So Donald Trump is trying to, I think, egg it up a little bit, this battle. And let's have a listen to him anyway, and we'll hear afterwards from Xi, and also finally from Vladimir Putin, who also had some interesting things to say at the General Assembly, which has hardly been covered at all in the Western press, even though it's the 75th anniversary of the UN. Actually, Martin, I've changed my mind. Before we hear from Donald Trump, is the UN still a viable operation? Is it still serving a useful purpose after 75 years?
Well, the Chinese and the Russians are determined that the UN is going to carry on being the main mechanism through which disputes are resolved. It's the US in particular that doesn't want international law. What they want is, what's the phrase they use? A rules-based system. But they don't want international law. International law is a rules-based system, but they want a rules-based system which isn't international law. In other words, their law. Just no justice.
Well,
this
is why we've got the Assange case going on.
Well, indeed, that's a classic example of the US trying to use its own internal laws as if they were extraterritorial and applied to anybody on the planet, at the same time going on about international law. They're not members of the International Criminal Court. They're trying to prosecute and harass the International Criminal Court. They're not members. They're not signatories to the chemical weapons and biological weapons conventions, and they're not signatories to the law of the sea. But nevertheless, everybody else has got to obey the rules, but the US, because it's an exceptional country, doesn't have to obey the rules, and that's in everybody's interest because they're so wise and good.
Actually, before we hear from Donald Trump, let's hear about someone much more important. His name is Julian Assange, and he's been taken back to Belmarsh prison at the end of this week. I think they're trying to wind the hearing up in 4 weeks altogether, so that's by the end of next week. During the hearing, says your man in the public gallery, Craig Murray, day 17, during the hearing of medical evidence in the last 3 days, the British government has been caught twice directly telling important lies about events in Belmarsh prison, each lie proven by documentary evidence. The common factor has been the medical records kept by Dr. Daly, head of the jail's medical service. There's also been, to put it in its very lightest, one apparent misrepresentation by Mr. Daly. Personally, I'm very wary of the kind of person who impresses Ross Kemp. Mr. Kemp's description of the medical wing at Belmarsh: security is on another level here, with 6 times more staff per inmate than the rest of the jail. Whilst in the medical wing or health care, Julian Assange was in effect in solitary confinement. 3 psychiatrists and a physician with extensive experience of treating trauma have all testified in court. Assange's mental and physical condition had deteriorated while he was in health care for several months. So what kind of doctors are these? Mengele doctors?
Well, I understand that he was being given psychotropic drugs, just as they used to do in Soviet mental hospitals.
Unfortunately, to do so, he must reveal, to explain these lies, says Craig Murray, details of Julian's medical condition, which I have withheld, but I think the situation is so serious that he believes that he has to do that. Professor Michael Koppelman gave evidence that, among other preparations for suicide, Julian Assange had hidden a razor blade in his folded underwear, but this had been discovered in a search of his cell. As I reported, Koppelman was subjected to an extremely aggressive cross-examination by James Lewis, which in the morning had focused on the notion that Assange's mental illness was simply malingering and that Koppelman had failed to detect this. The razor blade was a key factor in Lewis's browbeating of Koppelman, and he attacked him on it again and again. Lewis stated that Koppelman relied on the razor blade story for his diagnosis. He then proceeded to portray it as a fantasy concocted by Assange to support his malingering. Lewis asked Koppelman repeatedly why, if the story was true, it was not in Dr. Daly's clinical notes. So there is apparently no evidence for a razor blade, and yet this is being talked about, that Julian Assange had hidden a razor blade and intended to kill himself, and therefore they had to feed him drugs.
Well, I've been trying to follow this trial. I mean, it's extraordinary, the evidence that's coming out, and it ought to be front page news, because it's one of the most. Did you see this week? Lots of senior political figures from all over the world have written a joint letter to the British saying you've got to release this guy now. So there was an article in The Guardian, of all places, from Luis Inácio da Silva, who of course is still under house arrest for supposed corruption in Brazil, saying that he's got to be released, and various other people also going along with this, you know. So there's, you know, it's beginning to be a cause célèbre. It's a bit like the Dreyfus case in France back in the 19th century. And ultimately, it's quite possible, that he will be released. And we shall see what happens.
Apparently, there was a charge sheet, about a concealed razor blade. What Assange had told Koppelman and what Koppelman had believed was true in every single detail. In a scene straight out of a TV legal drama, during Koppelman's testimony, the defence had managed to obtain the charge sheet from Belmarsh Prison. Assange had been charged with the offence of the razor blade. The charge sheet is dated 0900 on the 7th of May 2019, and Craig Murray copies it here. So I'll put links up to that on our show page. It's not entirely clear to me as to whether this was real, or whether it was just concocted in order to give an excuse. But you can understand, actually, many warriors in World War II carried cyanide pills, Martin, didn't they?
That's right.
That they believed that if they were captured, obviously Julian Assange doesn't want to spend the rest of his life in US custody.
No, he doesn't.
And he may be. He would have the courage to kill himself.
I put it to people listening to this show. How would you feel after years and years and years in solitary confinement? Would you be happy? He's lost loads of weight.
And
ultimately, he should be released, and of course, he should get massive compensation.
So I'll put a link up to Your Man in the Public Gallery, Assange Hearing Day 17, the blog by Craig Murray on our show page at This Week. org.uk, and we'll go straight to Zoom in Washington. Actually, no, it's New York, isn't it? To have a listen to Donald Trump this week at the United Nations 75th General Assembly.
We pioneered life-saving treatments, reducing our fatality rate 85% since April. Thanks to our efforts, three vaccines are in the final stage of clinical trials. We are mass-producing them in advance so they can be delivered immediately upon arrival. We will distribute a vaccine. We will defeat the virus. We will end the pandemic. And we will enter a new era of unprecedented prosperity, cooperation, and peace. As we pursue this bright future, we must hold accountable the nation which unleashed this plague onto the world. China. In the earliest days of the virus, China locked down travel domestically while allowing flights to leave China and infect the world. China condemned my travel ban on their country, even as they canceled domestic flights and locked citizens in their homes. The Chinese government and the World Health Organization, which is virtually controlled by China, falsely declared that there was no evidence of human-to-human transmission. Later, they falsely said people without symptoms would not spread the disease. The United Nations must hold China accountable for their actions. In addition, every year, China dumps millions and millions of tons of plastic and trash into the oceans, overfishes other countries' waters, destroys vast swaths of coral reef and emits more toxic mercury into the atmosphere than any country anywhere in the world. China's carbon emissions are nearly twice what the U.S. has, and it's rising fast. By contrast, after I withdrew from the one-sided Paris Climate Accord, last year America reduced its carbon emissions by more than any country in the agreement. Those who attack America's exceptional environmental record while ignoring China's rampant pollution are not interested in the environment. They only want to punish America, and I will not stand for it. If the United Nations is to be an effective organization, it must focus on the real problems of the world.
So that's Donald Trump there, really just reading out a speech. But he's getting very, very belligerent about China, Martin. He's blaming them for the virus, which I suppose is kind of obvious. If his soldiers at the Wuhan military games had planted it there, he would be blaming it on them.
Well, interestingly enough, I read this week that the Hong Kong, she's Hong Kong-based, she's not actually a doctor, an epidemiologist, but she's been saying that she had evidence that it was a leak from Wuhan, it was a Chinese biological weapon, whatever. But she's been discredited by her own colleagues at Hong Kong University and said, well, she had nothing to do with it, and that she's just making it all up. But she, Steve Bannon was talking about her, I think, as being the insider that would blow open the fact that it was a Chinese biological weapon. But of course, he's under house arrest because of all this stuff that, you know, for, defrauding charity donations. But if the US wants to push, and the Murdoch press in Australia wants to push this idea that it's a biological weapon, that's a two-edged sword, because it possibly is a biological weapon, and if it is a biological weapon, it's the same people that carried out the 9/11 attacks.
I don't think they do want to push that. They don't. This is a China virus,
yes,
that's all.
Yeah.
But actually, are they saying they're sort of trying to hint that it might be a biological weapon, aren't they?
Some people in the Murdoch press and elsewhere are pushing the idea that it was a Chinese biological weapon. I'm willing to go there. If it is a biological weapon, it's probably something done by the deep state. Don't forget, we keep stressing this, the DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, told the Israeli Defense Force,
what's much more important than that is that we had Pentagon money in the Wuhan virology lab.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Maybe the Pentagon were in charge of this.
And in actual fact, it's extraordinary to imagine, but the Chinese have probably kicked themselves. Why did we allow the Pentagon to invest in our biological lab, one of these
spiders like Henry Kissinger that has fingers in both camps? Well, that persuades one university in China to have a load of stuff. What they might be doing is military stuff under civilian cover in China and have these wonderful exchange programs. It's a bit like Gaddafi having an exchange program with Tony Blair, isn't it? He ends up having a coup against him and the West.
Well,
I mean, this is the trouble, isn't it? When you get somebody who's got fingers in both pies or in both camps, like Kissinger, and I really do suspect Kissinger's is the sort of guy that would be sitting there trying very cleverly with the diplomats in China and the US to say, well, we've got to have some nice, you know, sort of civilian program to kind of get things going. It only turns out that it ends up planting a bioweapon on them.
Yes, I mean, that's broadly what may have happened here, but I think the Chinese have probably realised they shouldn't be involved in joint enterprises with the Pentagon.
Isn't it what Putin said is the Americans are not deal ready, so let's not do deals with them.
Well, indeed, but of course the Chinese up to now have been playing the game of let's all cooperate together for the common good.
And they're continuing to do that this week at the UN General Assembly, and I'll put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Whatever your favourite country you're interested in, it might be Qatar, which is an interesting place. It might be UAE. Lots of interesting stuff going on there right now. It might be Turkey, and the Erdogan at the UN has been calling out China's treatment of Muslims in Kashmir. Very few people seem...
In Kashmir, all right.
Yeah, it's very few people seem to be talking about that anymore, even though it's almost like a year of turning that place into a prison camp. But anyway, let's have a listen now to President Xi and see how he replies to all these accusations from Donald Trump.
The virus will be defeated. Humanity will win this battle. Facing the virus, we should put people and life first. We should mobilize all resources to make a science-based and targeted response. No case should be missed, and no patient should be left untreated. The spread of the virus must be contained. Facing the virus, we should enhance solidarity and get this through together. We should follow the guidance of science, give full play to the leading role of the World Health Organization, and launch a joint international response to beat this pandemic. Any attempt of politicizing the issue or stigmatization must be rejected. Facing the virus, we should adopt comprehensive and long-term control measures. We should reopen businesses and schools in an orderly way so as to create jobs, boost the economy, and restore economic and social order and vitality. The major economies need to step up micro-policy coordination. We should not only restart our own economies, but also contribute to global recovery.
So that's it's not actually President Xi, because he speaks in Chinese, but that's the translation of what he was saying yesterday or the day before at the UN General Assembly on Zoom, or some other system similar to Zoom, that they're using now on the 75th anniversary, Martin, of the United Nations.
Well, I mean, what he was basically saying there is fairly common sense stuff, rather than the rabble-rousing that we heard from the US president previously.
What do you make of the way that the UN operates, though? We've got these two main organisations, the Security Council and the General Assembly. This is the big bash for the General Assembly, isn't it? Where they get together in September every year. And they actually haven't got together, but it does give all of the world leaders a chance to give a speech and, you know, to put forward what their views are. And like I say, I'll put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to the UN's YouTube channel, where you can pick up all this stuff and have a look, see what they're saying, because we're not getting anything really much from the mass media at all, picking up bits of interesting speeches. Martin?
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of people, it's a very abstract thing, the UN General Assembly, what the hell's that? Especially in the West, you know, they've got plenty of things to think about, like what's happening on EastEnders and when the football coming back.
No, I'm talking about political reporters. I mean, this is actually quite an important event in the world, and I was very shocked to see just no coverage of it. Well, except Trump. There was a bit of a clip of Trump.
Yeah.
That was it.
I mean, well, that's the, you know.
It's not as if Trump
we're,
is. Trump
we're only is, really interested in ourselves, aren't we?
Trump is not leader of the world, is he? We've got all sorts of other interesting people saying interesting stuff.
Well, indeed. But we don't get any genuine reporting of what the Chinese or the Russians are saying, do we?
We won't hear what Russia is saying, evil Putin is saying.
Well, you will
on this programme, because what he's done is he started off talking about the Security Council. He wants some changes in the way it operates. He believes that maybe it's getting a little bit past its sell-by date. He's not saying that it's not a useful institution. He's saying it's very useful, but that there could potentially be some tweaking. And also, he's very concerned about the economic impact of the virus.
Our thinking is that the Security Council should be more inclusive of the interests of all countries, as well as the diversity of their positions, base its work on the principle of the broadest possible consensus among states, and, at the same time, continue to serve as the cornerstone of global governance, which cannot be achieved unless the permanent members of the Security Council retain their veto power. Such a right pertaining to the five nuclear powers, the victors of the Second World War, remains indicative of the actual military and political balance to this day. Most importantly, it is an essential and unique instrument that helps prevent unilateral actions that may result in a direct military confrontation between major states, and provides an opportunity to seek compromise or at least avoid solutions that would be completely unacceptable to others and act within the framework of international law rather than a vague grey area of arbitrariness and illegitimacy. As diplomatic practice shows, this instrument actually works, unlike the infamous pre-war League of Nations, with its endless discussions, declarations without mechanisms for real action, and with states and peoples in need not having the right to assistance and protection. Forgetting the lessons of history is short-sighted and extremely irresponsible, just like the politicized attempt to arbitrarily interpret the causes, course, and outcomes of the Second World War, and twist the decisions of the conferences of the Allies and the Nuremberg Tribunal that are based on speculation instead of facts. It is not just vile and offensive to the memories of the victims, the fighters against Nazism. It is a direct and devastating blow to the very foundation of the post-war world order, which is particularly dangerous in view of the global stability facing serious challenges. The arms control system breaking down, regional conflicts continuing unabated, and threats posed by terrorism, organized crime, and drug trafficking intensifying. We are also experiencing a whole new challenge of the coronavirus pandemic. This disease has directly affected millions of people and claimed the most important thing, the lives of hundreds of thousands of people. Quarantines, border closures, numerous serious troubles to the citizens of almost all states constitute the present-day realia. It has been especially difficult for elderly people who, due to the necessary restrictions, have not been able to hug their loved ones, children and grandchildren, for weeks or even months. Experts are yet to fully assess the scale of the social and economic outlook caused by the pandemic and all its long-term consequences. However, it is already evident that it will take a really, really long time to restore the global economy.
A very, very long time to restore the global economy. Martin, maybe the global economy is now shot. It's just a question of a ticking time bomb.
Pretty much. But of course, both Xi and Putin are trying to argue in favour of, you know, a modified UN system, which, of course, the with what's happened over the Iran deal, for example, the US seems to be saying, well, we're just not interested in that old-fashioned balanced system.
I guess what,
we want a unipolar system.
I guess what they're saying is that by trying to get round the UN Security Council system, the US is kind of making itself an international pariah.
Well, it is making itself an
international... They didn't actually say that, but it's really between the lines. That's what they're suggesting.
Well, I think what's beginning to happen, don't forget, for example, the US withdrew from the World Health Organization. They're not in part of the International Criminal Court. They haven't ratified the Chemical and Biological Weapons Conventions. Basically, all the serious stuff. They've ripped up the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. Basically, they are ignoring all of the agreements that have been made over the last 30 years.
Isn't it becoming like the United States and Britain and possibly Israel too against the whole of the rest of the world?
Pretty much. And of course,
except for Saudi Arabia, maybe.
Saudi Arabia is part of that evil alliance. Not that they have, you know, this is part of the hypocrisy of the West going on about human rights, etc.
I mean, Putin's in
and
quite
it's all based on working with the Saudis.
Putin's in quite a strong position, though, isn't he, as a sort of swing state between China and US.
Yeah, well, what's actually happening in international relations is that China and Russia, who've actually got quite a lot of, you know, difficulties in their relationship, are being forced to cooperate because of the basically unacceptable attitude of the Americans. And Kissinger, for one, is not very happy about it. His policy was always to try and use one the Chinese against the Russians or vice versa. But you've got such arrogance inside the ruling elite in the West that they think that they can pick on them both simultaneously and that they won't gang up on them. And of course, once these infrastructures have been created so that the Chinese have access to all of the raw materials in Siberia and that the Chinese then invest heavily in the Russian economy, they are trying to build on the world island, as Mackinder called it, an economic powerhouse which will basically leave the West for dead.
Well, let's see what happens with the Great Reset, because that may be part of all of that. And what do you think? Or not?
Well, the Great Reset and the crashing of the Western financial markets is in order to try and make sure that China and Russia do not fulfil their potential economically. That's what it's all about. And of course, the West.
So if we can't control you, we'll ruin you.
Yeah, that's right. If it's a dog in the manger approach. If we can't control it, you can't have it.
So the World Economic Forum's techno-totalitarian roadmap, that's in Technocracy News, It's a few months ago this, but Klaus Schwab, president of the World Economic Forum, and UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres signed a partnership between the two organizations. This was done without any direct media attention, despite tremendous implications this poses to humanity. By and large, this means that the power over our lives with the stroke of a pen has been transferred to the big global corporations and their owners. The agreement, this article says, and I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk as usual. That is the article. Is headline is World Economic Forum's Techno-Totalitarian Roadmap. The agreement includes six focus areas: funding for the UN Agenda 2030, climate change, health, digital collaboration, gender equality, women's lib, and education and skills development. Now, it does sound as if there is this kind of economic policy developing between the World Economic Forum and the UN, Martin, which is likely to steer policy around the world. At least that's the idea. Part of this great reset is to start steering policy on an international level with the World Economic Forum in the driving seat.
Well, there is going to be big changes whatever now. I mean, we're definitely in the period of where there is going to be dramatic social and political changes. The question is, who's going to be in the driving seat, and where are we going?
I'll tell you who's going to be in the driving seat. It's Klaus Schwab. He's the founder of the World Economic Forum.
Yes, I know, but he's a spokesperson for other forces. Yeah. He's basically a
well, he may have somebody pulling his strings, but he's still sitting there in the driver's seat. Anyway, so the
West has got its own vision of what should happen. And of course the Chinese and the Russians have got a counter
vision. And he's got a bit of a negative message. He sounds a bit like you here, Martin. He's talking recently about, he thinks everyone's going to get a lot more angry in the next few months. Would you agree with that?
That's possibly, it's like a global strategy of tension, a global gladio. Isn't it?
Well, in what way? What do you mean by that?
Well, the banking system started collapsing in September last year, and BlackRock, who are basically a hedge fund, have been given full control of US economic policy, which means full control of global economic policy. And that's already happened. And there's going to be a crash now. And as you say, the clever people will have all the money stashed away, so they're going to buy everything up for pennies on the dollar.
It's a kind of privatisation as well, though, isn't it?
Well, of course it is. It's a way. If the great reset in the mind of the oligarchs is to put them firmly in the driving seat. But the great reset could be, if the Chinese communists stick to their communist values, etc., is that the oligarchs are the ones who are put in the dustbin of history.
Well, let's have a listen now, anyway, to the guy who's going to be in charge of it. I think almost we should be looking at what these folk are up to every week, really, here. Klaus Schwab here talking about, in a kind of threatening way, rather like Henry Kissinger was a few months ago in the middle of the pandemic, talking about, well, you know, unless you sort out a global response to this, and people like David Miliband were even put forward as the people who should be leading that global response, then the world will be catching on fire. Now, he's saying a similar thing here, Klaus Schwab is, as the president of the World Economic Forum, about the Great Reset. We must prepare for an angrier world, he says.
What we know is that we will end up with many more unemployed, and particularly also people in the grey economy, which are not counted for, who lose their jobs. So we will see definitively a lot of anger already now, but probably increase by the end of the year, because this crisis will be with us until we really have found a remedy. So we have to prepare for a more angry world. And how to prepare? It means to take the necessary action to create a fairer world, to see that we provide everybody with decent access to the health system, that we make sure that those people who are really left behind, and I'm not speaking only on national levels, I'm speaking also internationally. If I see now the tragedy in some of the emerging countries like South Africa, like some countries in East Asia, I think it's all, I don't have too many remedies. The remedies have to be discussed through dialogue by the stakeholders of our global system, but I just see the need for such a dialogue, and I see the need for action. I see the need for a great reset.
Well, here he is selling his great reset. Would you buy a used car from Klaus Schwab, Martin?
Well, at the end of the day, all he's saying is motherhood and apple pie. Wouldn't it be nice if people had access to healthcare? Yes, it would. Now, which country...
He represents some of the people that control most of the wealth in the world.
Yes, so in other words, he's saying us wealthy people, we care too. Of course we do.
And he's saying it's going to go from an angry world to a fairer world. Do you trust him?
Well, if an angry world goes to a fairer world via what Mao Zedong would call a revolution. And, of course, the Chinese are building a fairer world, but it's on the back of millions of Chinese who died in their revolution. And I'm afraid that the world doesn't change necessarily through posh, wealthy people like Klaus Schwab starting to talk as if they cared. That really is by the by. When the real movement starts happening, we will see, as the Chinese say, when the two rice bowls clash, we will see which one is fuller.
Finishing this week with David Livingstone again. And before we hear from him, Martin, I'll just ask you a little bit about this, because he's putting the jigsaw together, looking at links between the British spy Jamal Afghani and the Islamic terror groups like the Salafists today. He's saying basically that the British, during the early days of empire and middle, sort of in the 1800s of empire, were deliberately going around seeding these sorts of alternative movements to Islam. Do you think that's, does it really go back that far or not?
No, not in my view. If you want a straightforward answer.
Okay, well, let's have a listen to what he's saying here. Eventually, that this tradition led to some of the individuals that were behind things like Operation Gladio. So let's see. He's going to try and join the dots. Let's see if Martin, after we've heard from David Livingstone, whether you agree with him or not.
So what Jamal Afghani tried to say was that the reason why Islam was falling behind the West was because the doors of jihad had been closed. So he called for...
Actually, I read those writings by Jamaluddin Afghani myself.
Right. So he was a British agent?
Yes. Okay.
He was a British agent, both him and Muhammad Abdu. Muhammad Abdu in particular was in direct contact with Lord Cromer. Jamal Afghani was in contact with Scowen Blunt. I think it was Edward Scowen Blunt? Wilfred Scowen Blunt. And so what their goal was to create a neo-caliphate. And so they were also in contact with Abdul Qadir al-Jazairi, who's another important character I'll mention, who was also Grand Master of the Freemasons, despite the fact that he's very famous. He was also involved with the Shadidli Sufi order. They all were. That's a very important tradition to follow, but we'll get to that point. And So what Jamali Afghani's point was to call for a reopening of the doors of jihad to be able to rewrite Islam, which is what they've done. Right? So that's the point of Salafism. The point of Salafism is basically to undermine the Madhab tradition and to create a British version of Islam that would allow them to write a new version that was adaptable to British colonialism. So Jamal Afghani is a notorious, intriguer, subverter. So what he does now is he poses as a guy named Haji Sharif, who claims to be an Afghan prince. And who does he make contact with? He makes contact with a guy named Alexandre Saint-Yves Dalvendre. And why he's important is Dalvendre, it becomes the founder of what's called Synarchism. And Synarchism claims to be the political system that was adopted by the inhabitants of a civilization in the hollow earth called Agartha. And it's very closely related to a similar concept taught by Blavatsky called Shambhala. Both of them are supposedly located in, somewhere around Tibet, and to preserve basically the ancient teachings of the Aryans. So Synarchism becomes the underlying occult ideology of 20th century fascism. So Jamal Afghani is responsible for three trajectories, actually. Theosophy through Elena Blavatsky and ultimately leading to the New Age movement. Through Salafism, which then becomes adopted by the Saudi state, who were installed by the British and supported by Rockefeller Oil. And then thirdly, Cynicism, which becomes, this is what I detail in Black Terror White Soldiers. Cynicism is a occult tradition which is not recognized by a lot of researchers, especially Muslims. But that is this is what I expose. That is the key to the relationship between the Western Masons and the Muslim Brotherhood. So, you know, I mean, that's the point. That's a separate trajectory. So basically the Muslim Brotherhood becomes the organization that was, first of all, it was commissioned by Hitler, who commissioned Hassan al-Banna to create the organization. They first were in the employ of the Germans. When the Germans lost the war, then it got taken over by the CIA, but they continued to use neo-Nazis to coordinate with them. So that's why you find that right up until very recently, the Muslim Brotherhood had extensive relationships with neo-Nazis, particularly François Genoux. So François Genoux is very important because he's considered to be the guy who's in charge of the Nazi gold, basically the treasure, the bulk of the assets, of post-war assets of the Nazis, and another guy named Ahmed Huber, who was part of what's called Avalon Gesellschaft. So now there's too many points to discuss. I can't get into the point.
We have more than one session, but yeah. Alhamdulillah, Allah has blessed you with tremendous amount of information and knowledge, and even you have been able to connect all this to Islam.
The most important exponent of Cynicism in our time is a guy named Alexander Dugin. So out of Cynarchy, the most important, basically developer of the tradition of Cynicism is a guy named François René Guénon. And so René Guénon created a tradition of what's now called traditionalism. The next follower after him is a guy named Julius Evola, who is an Italian fascist philosopher. He's the guy who was the main ideologue behind the Gladio operation, which is a CIA operation. And so today, that guy is a guy named Alexander Dugin.
So there's lots and lots of dots he's joining there, Martin. But, you know, this does sound, if there's an air of credibility to this to me, the British Empire obviously realised that, you know, that Muslims, it was much better if you could control some, to a certain extent, Islam, not allowing them to go their own way, but to set up kind of fake versions of Islam, which were actually secretly run by the British. And this intelligence officer, he says, was an intelligence officer called Jamal Afghani, eventually leading, he says, the people who created the Gladio networks. And those, of course, were used, have been used in what Sybil Edmonds would describe as Gladio B, in order to set up Muslims. So what do you make of that? Do you think he would be laughed out of court if he was giving a lecture at Oxford?
I think there'd be lots of professional historians who would dispute aspects of what he's saying there. For example, I'll just pick up one thing. The Muslim Brotherhood was started by the British in Egypt as a means of undermining secular nationalists. So they weren't started by the Nazis at all. And they've been, actually, the Muslim Brotherhood is seen around the world as basically a British or now US, cat's paw, and has been for many years. The Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia were put in power by the British, you remember Lawrence of Arabia and all the rest of it, and so we've created this, and don't forget, in the 1980s, Operation, what was it called? Operation Cyclone was the biggest undercover operation in history, paid for by your taxes, British listeners, to train the Salafist terrorists from Saudi Arabia and elsewhere to kill Russian soldiers in Afghanistan. And then, we are told, they turned on their masters and carried out 9/11, even though we're still providing them with weaponry and training to try and overthrow the government of Syria as we speak. Now, in actual fact, extremist Salafist Islam has always been in the pocket of Western imperialists. And that's why they're deadly enemies of the Iranians, and we are on their side.
So as its influence grew, the Muslim Brotherhood opposed British rule in Egypt. So that does suggest that maybe it wasn't the British.
No, they opposed British rule in Egypt. But it's a bit like Hamas.
It's a counter gang.
It's a counter gang, yes, to use Frank Kitson's term. And Hamas was originally created by Israeli intelligence to undermine the PLO. And what the sort of Rhodes circle people in Western imperialism tried to do. They tried to encourage the most extreme and reactionary forms of Islam as a means of undermining what they regarded at that time as their main enemies, which were secular nationalists like Nasser, etc.
But I mean, isn't it possible, even if the British created it, that the Nazis would want to infiltrate it and use it as a cat's paw to smash the British in Egypt?
Well, yes, indeed. And everybody tries to infiltrate everybody else and tries to steer things in the direction they want them to go. That is true. But of course, the Germans were very late appearers on the international imperialist scene, not least because they lost the First World War and were kicked out of all their colonies and so on. So it's basically the British, and then followed by them, the Americans, who created the State of Israel and the State of Saudi Arabia, which are, you know, two which are now, of course, pretty much closely allied, with the West, destroying Yemen as we speak and creating misery, untold misery across the planet.
How's it going to end then, do you think?
Well,
you're going to tell me badly, aren't you?
Well, yes, I'm afraid so. People are going to have to face up to the fact, as they did in previous generations, that the people in charge are not just incompetent, they're evil, and their goals are evil, and there's going to have to be huge sacrifices, I'm afraid.
I'll just finish on one news story, which is one of the main stories today, about the killing of a policeman in Croydon. I can remember being told by Ian Matteson, who was a former Freemason, who died a couple of months ago, that Croydon had the worst reputation amongst the Freemasons anywhere in the country. So the Freemasons had been there, the lodges in Croydon had been working for many, many decades to just give themselves planning permission, make money like that. And so it might simply be that Croydon is not a very good place to be, simply because of the criminal fraternity being rather too close to law enforcement. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest in the first hour and in the second hour. That is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page, and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.